Welcome to Unlimited Realities. This is Lisa Zimmer. I'm your host today, and I'm just thrilled to offer today's show for you. You're going to learn so much. And what we have, I have a wonderful guest as our first guest on the show, and her name is Linda Smarzik. She's an artist, writer, educator, and has been teaching the creative process to adult learners for over three decades. Her unique insights regarding the interplay between brain function and the process of creativity intensified following a 1999 trek to Nepal. So Linda is our guest today who wrote The Mind of Thoos, Thriving Within Effortlessness, and it is the neuroscience and creativity that we're going to discuss today. So without further ado, Linda, welcome to Unlimited Realities. Thank you for being my guest today. Uh-oh, Linda. Hi,
hello.
Linda.
Hello. Hi, yes.
Hi, Linda.
Here you are.
Welcome to Unlimited Realities. I'm sorry, there is a little blip on my thing here. So here we are. Welcome, Linda Smarzik, the author of The Mind of Thoos, Thriving Within Effortlessness, and we're going to discuss neuroscience and creativity today. Welcome to Unlimited Realities, Linda.
Thank you, Lisa. That was a wonderful introduction, and I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I absolutely loved your book. This is one of those really dynamic books that if you want to change how you're perceiving life and tweak your life a little better and take responsibility, this is the book to have next to your bed, The Mind of Thoos, Thriving Within Effortlessness. And you know what I really loved was how you took neuroscience, which a lot of people become intimidated by, and you explain how neuroplasticity can actually retrain our brain and how we can take responsibility over our lives. So Let's get into the beginning here. Let's talk about first, the process of creativity. And you told a little story in the beginning about a friend of yours, Jane, whose car broke down and her process. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that.
So Jane, a dear friend, was stalled in the parking lot. Her car had broken down, and she called me one evening, and I hopped over there. And just as soon as I got there, I realized she was very, very nervous, very scared about her car. And she, her, what had happened is she had gone from that really lovely an alpha brainwave state where we're able to think things through, where we're able to be creative, and then the cerebral cortex where we can actually problem solve. And she had gone into fight, flight, or freeze, and she was freaked out, so to speak. So from that, she couldn't make a decision. Her ability to think, to solve problems, gone, and she ended up making a horrible mistake in letting the guy tow off her car, and to someone he knew who could fix the car. The next day she received a bid for, I want to say $750, $850, which she didn't have. She only had about less than a couple hundred dollars in her bank. So she calmed down. She realized that she needed to be able to, she herself was a meditator, so she calmed down, and in that she was able to remember the name of somebody who she trusted. She got a bid from this car repairman, and it was less than a couple of hundred dollars, $230. And from there, she was able to get her car back and repaired in just a couple of days. And that, to me, is the difference from when a problem happens. If we can learn to just stay calm, more than likely a solution may show up eventually, compared to going into that fight, flight, or freeze, which a lot of us spend our time in that fight, flight, or freeze portion of our brain.
Right.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, with today's world and the circumstances that put everybody on edge and make them feel vulnerable and not in control of security and finances, that fight or flight seems to take on a whole new essence. And you discuss a lot, well, you discuss in your book, and you refer to it a bit, we come back to it, about the three brains. So let's talk about a little bit about the three aspects of our brain and how we can evolve through that from coming out of that fight and flight.
Sure. So over millions of years, our brain has evolved from first what is called the reptile brain. And that brain is how we just can function on with our automatic responses. This is where we digest our food, we breathe, you know, we're able to procreate with this brain. A reptile brain. Then the next brain to evolve millions of years later is more the emotional brain. This is where the fight, flight, or freeze lives. This is where the limbic system lives. And this is where we're able to, we have memories, and from these memories we create perceptions and our belief systems. The third brain to evolve many, many years later is the cerebral cortex, or that creative learning brain. And this is where we can problem solve, and there's language, and we're able to think through, you know, based on what the other two brains are unable to do. And that's the brain that separates us for the most part from, you know, other species. And when we understand that, and when we can find out I'm stressed, okay, I'm in that fight, flight, or freeze, I'm in the lizard brain, we can make a decision. It's like, wait a minute, you know, I don't have to be in this brain. I can breathe a few times and ask myself in this moment, is what I am going through real? Because most of the times we make things up in our brain that we think are real, but more than likely it's not.
Right, right. And how can we learn to work more with our effortlessness? Because as we're creating these little, you know, stories up in our brain, and we're exaggerating the emotional impact in ourselves, and things are escalating out of our control, how can we rein that back in and start to gain composure and work within effortlessness?
Sure. That for what I do is I generally, 50% of being able to stop the problem is to recognize it. Because a lot of times we go into that reactive brain state and we don't know we're in it. We're afraid, we're mad, we're whatever. But if we can just stop, and number one is recognize it, we're already 50% there in being able to handle that moment. Then we have to ask ourselves just a few questions. What am I about to lose, which is one that's very important to me, and that was the one that Jane, she finally came to when she was thinking she was going to lose her car. She asked herself, am I about to lose my car? No, I can, yes, I'm about to lose my car, but what does that represent? And for her, it represented freedom. And then when she realized, wait a minute, I'm not going to lose my freedom. I can get a couple of friends to drive me around to the grocery store to my job. I'm not really going to lose anything. So when you get to those questions, recognize it. What am I about to lose? Well, in this moment, really nothing. For the most part, you know, that doesn't cover the bandwidth. And then from there, we can move into what can I do to make things different? Am I truly out of control of the situation and have no ability to change it, or can I change it? And one of my favorite little mantra prayers, I don't know what we will call it, comes from Alcoholics Anonymous. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Oh, my God, that is so powerful.
I love that one.
Uh-huh. And so just being able to do that quick little process and some deep breaths, you can calm ourselves down and move into, you know, not from that reactive brain, but into more and that high frequency beta brainwave state, but it's something that's more into the alpha brainwave state. Okay, so now we have what I call the, you know, we're starting to balance. We're are no longer in that reactive brain, and then we have to make a choice of what can I do in this moment to create something that's more learned optimism. Jane may have said, oh, I should have taken my car in for an oil change, or beat herself up a little bit. So if she can do something with learned optimism, okay, in this moment, everything, it's okay. It's better than I can possibly imagine. And then combine that with just really tiny baby steps. And what I mean by baby steps, it's something that takes between a minute and an hour. We then balance are what I call the triangle of thews, the outer triangle of thews. And then to move into effortlessness, then we go into whatever it is, the problem that we're working on in that moment, we're able to create a little bit of enthusiasm. From that enthusiasm, we're able to create a focus. And then from that focus, we're able to create what I call effortless effort in that moment. And then we move up into this triangle until we ultimately get into the process of effortlessness. Now, for me to explain it is one thing, but to experience it is a whole other realm. And the neuroscience, being able to apply that in day-to-day life, you know, that's what this work is all about. And then to be able to apply it in day-to-day life while being able to tap into our process of creativity, whoa, you know, that's an amazing place to be.
Right. And you also bring in a little bit about our feelings within our stomach area. And a lot of times, our stomach is being called our second brain. Can we get into a little bit of that, how we intuitively feel things and on those emotions?
So I have this place where I call it the guiding quiet, and I didn't bring it as much up in this particular book because I'm going into a workbook next. And the guiding quiet, the quieter we get, I find, the quieter we get, the gut, the stomach is able to know, is that right, is that wrong? And for me, you know, sometimes even when I'm driving around, I can get quiet enough to where I literally hear, no, don't turn right, turn left. Now, for some people might go, that woman's crazy. But really, I think of that as being able to tap into that really quiet soothe space that, you know, comes from the stomach, from the gut, from being able to move into the next moment without thinking. And that's the part, that's when it gets really exciting, when we can do without doing, when we can move into that next moment without a whole lot of effort. Then we're doing that work. We're doing the work.
Wonderful, wonderful. Now, how difficult is it for the average person to be mindful, take responsibility, take a deep breath, and calm down? Are there certain tools that some people may benefit quicker or easier from than other people, or some blocks that may prevent people from kind of embracing this easier?
What I always come back to is that it's our perceptions that create our belief system that then become memories in the brain. And then when those memories or those perceptions are challenged, and that triggers all sorts of neurotransmitters, and that creates that fight, flight, or freeze. Sometimes the average person, if they can just see, wait a minute, I'm going into that, into that reactive brain, and then they can stop in that moment for me, and they can take 5 deep breaths. It's probably something as simple as wearing a ring that reminds one of it, wearing some sort of bracelet, or having an index card or sticky notes all over the place. That's the first part, to train the person to realize when they're going into a reactive brain state. That's number one. Then after that, I tell, you know, people, a lot of people who do this work have their own toolkits, and some of the tools in my toolkit would be EFT, Emotional Freedom Technique. I just love that work. That's one of my mainstays. Other tools may be for people where they can do Qigong, or they just walk, or they listen to music. Another one of my favorite tools is being able to listen to music that has binaural beats in the background that can take my brain from a Chatty Cathy beta state to an alpha, and then integrate it with that theta state. That's another one of my favorite tools to use. There are hundreds of tools, but for people, it's just the ability to find their own toolkit that helps them to get calm in this state. But I think the first thing is to recognize when we are reacting. That's number one.
Okay, that's wonderful. And you know, you have a wonderful example in the book in regard to building your effortless toolkit. And I just want to read just briefly to give people an idea of some of the examples that you would want to include. And you have in here that you want to keep in mind everyone has their own personal strategies and techniques for working with struggle. However, when quieting struggle, there's five guidelines that you would want to follow. And the first guideline you discuss is you recognize, like you just said, you recognize and acknowledge that you're actually in a struggle. And number two, you would take the time to uncover the perceptions and beliefs that you form on the thistle thoughts. Now, when you talk about the thistle thoughts, are those the thistle thoughts of like they kind of create more drama in the brain?
Mm-hmm. That's a good way to explain it, yes. Yes.
Okay. And so then we move into number three, and we use our personal techniques or tools that identify and perhaps express the emotions behind those destructive thistle thoughts. I love that. I love that word, thistle thoughts. And then you build a neutral network based on your thoughts, your statements, and you muster up feelings such as gratitude, joy to accompany the new thought or statement. The examples that you offer really put people in a realm of making something that may have become a little bit of a mountain out of a molehill and bringing it back into reality and making them feel much more in control of the issue at hand. And, you know, so many times in argument, in confrontation, people lose themselves in the argument itself, and then after the end, both people are exhausted. There's things that were said that were not beneficial. There was no real readying of the issue at hand where any resolution came to be. So by using this book and the tools that you have in this, I see such profound improvement in people's intimate relationships because they're taking responsibility and they actually have a toolkit that they can use, that they can refer back to, and they can maybe shut their mouth, be a little bit more mindful. Take a few deeper breaths. And you know, it's simple in concept, but so much more difficult in practice. And go ahead. Take off on that.
Well, I do believe it's very simple in concept. These are simple, simple steps that, I myself have been training myself in this way for years. And it started from going down a mountain in Nepal, and that's where it all started. But even I sometimes will turn around and go, oh, I'm really mad at this person for this particular thing. I will go off. I can see it, and that's the part that I think for me, yay, hero, yay, I can see it. Now, it'll take me quite some time, 30 minutes, 40 minutes to calm down, but I do believe that if two people are using this in relationship, that they can be able to talk through and become much more productive towards the other end of that argument rather than it being the explosive argument that so oftentimes happens. And I love that you just actually unveiled that because I have never really looked at it that way, and now I'm looking at it that way and realize, wow, that really could work for a relationship in terms of an argument. I've often thought of it as what can we do with ourselves and bring ourselves into line, into alignment with something that's a little bit with a higher purpose. But two people using it, oh boy, that's exciting.
Because we work with others outside of our home life. It seems like when I'm talking to people, we're the most forgetful with the ones we care the most about. We're so much more mindful and considerate and compassionate and understanding with mere strangers than we are with our loved ones. And so, these are concepts that I think if we can start to practice it at home, with our spouses, with our relationships, with our children, if we can really take responsibility in being more mindful with our words, more compassionate and understanding, then those little neural pathways are going to get really ingrained in us and we're going to develop these wonderful new habits so much easier. And I just see this evolution happening with people when they start to take responsibility with these tools that you offered, that, gosh, you've just cracked open the cosmic egg. I mean, you're giving the power back two people who are kind of wandering around aimlessly, not knowing how to communicate with one another, because the world's gotten a little complicated, and we're a little touchy.
Yes.
You know, and so if we can all just step back a little bit and know that, hey, there are tools where we can better ourselves and we can better this situation and we can actually improve our relationship, God bless us. And thank you, Linda, for creating this book.
Well, thank you so much. It took. There were three of us. I was the writer, but then I had a wonderful editor, and then another person who knows this work in and out, up and down, and she helped with the conceptual aspects about it. And we would sit there and talk for hours, and so it was not just one person who put this all together.
Oh, well, it is a wonderful, wonderful book. And I think that this is something that everybody who wants to improve upon their personal intimate relationships, whether it's business, whether it's family, whether it's love, this book is priceless. And The Mind of Suze, Thriving Within Effortlessness, and we all want effortlessness because life is complicated sometimes. And it seems like these topics of neuroplasticity, neuroscience, many people are intimidated by the word. And so instead of delving into it and trying to explore what it is and how to improve upon it, they step back and they never walk into it. So to take the scariness out of this and to bring it back into the individual's hands, I find is phenomenally powerful. And I thank you, Linda.
I thank you, Lisa, for this delightful talk. That's great.
Oh, I have just thoroughly enjoyed you, and I look forward to your whatever new work you have coming out so we can stay in touch and have you on again, because you are a wonderful guest. Wonderful.
Thank you so
wonderful.
Much.
Thank you so much. Again, I want to bring everybody to your website, so if you want to tell the audience how they can reach you and how they can find you, be my guest.
Thank you. Website is onebreathvillage.com, and you can reach me directly at Linda@onebreathvillage.com, and there's now a forum up for the book itself, which is really nice. I just put it up a couple of days ago, and people can go through chapter by chapter if they want to and start talking with each other, and that's exciting when that starts to happen, and that's how you can get in touch.
Wonderful, wonderful. God bless you, Linda, and God bless your work. Thank you so much for bringing this to the audience, because the more we take responsibility for our words and our actions, the more peaceful the world will be, and I am all for that.
Thank you so much, Lisa. It's great.
Thank you, Linda. Have a wonderful day. God bless.
You too. God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was a wonderful segment. I really enjoy bringing the audience, you guys, the listeners, to have such a wonderful guest who is full of information and full of insight and allows us a different perspective and a different way of handling our lives. So where we're going to go now is more into our inspirational piece. Our first piece is our informative piece, which is also quite inspirational in and of itself. But this next segment is quite emotional. And I read Dave Moore's book. It is a true story. It's called The Father's Love, and it's amid a frantic search for his son, a father finds his faith. It's a bronze reader's favorite and an award winner. It's a very easy read, and if you are a parent, you will not stop until you finish the book because it grabs you at the core. It makes you feel this father's love and desperation. And it also taps you on the shoulder in regard to your own faith and ability to evolve as a soul, as a parent, and as a person connected in source to God. So we're going to, without further ado, I'm going to introduce our next guest, which is Dave Moore. And Dave wrote the book, The Father's Love. And it is a very, very powerful, impactful book that tells his true life story of having to go search for his son and how he found his faith in the process. So without further ado, I'm bringing our second guest on the show, Dave Moore. Dave, thank you so much for being our guest on Unlimited Realities today. I absolutely loved your book, The Father's Love. Thank you for being our guest today. Hello, Dave. Hello, Dave. Hi, Dave. Okay, Dave's on hold for some reason. Bear with me, folks. I'll get this going. I really will. Okay, here we go. Let's see. Dave, can you hear me? Hi, Dave.
Yes, I can.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you, Lisa?
I'm great. I am going to introduce you again. Audience, this is Dave Moore, the author of The Father's Love. He wrote a true story, very poignant, very powerful, and full of faith and courage. Dave, your book was phenomenal. I absolutely loved it. Thank you for writing it.
Oh, it was just something that so many people I'd told the story to, they said this really needs to be turned into a book or turned into a movie. And not really being a writer, it took me a while to even begin it. But once I got started, God just kept bringing it all back to me. And it really turned out to be such a blessing to not just to us to have shared our story, but to many others that have read it.
And it is so inspirational. And for somebody who claims they're not a writer, you wrote this beautifully. It is so spoken from the heart, and it is so genuine and authentic and feeling. And when something triggers my emotional connection, I'm all over it. So, you know, I thought this was so well written, but the piece that I got was, you know, the emotional piece, where you found your faith. So let's start at the beginning of the story. You're a typical dad. You're a dad. You're a married husband. You love your kids, your family. Your home is important. And you have a beloved dog, Tawny, who is a German Shepherd. I have a German Shepherd, too, so I relate to that connection. But you come home from work, a typical Friday in December, and you go play with your dog out back, and you don't think anything is unusual till your wife comes home, goes upstairs to check on the kids, and finds a note from your oldest son. Tell us how that unfolded and where you went from there, Dave.
Well, excuse me. Like you said, you know, I was home for a while. It was early December. We were planning Christmas. Actually, it was my youngest son, David. And,
okay.
And he was a freshman. Yeah, he was a freshman in college, and so he wasn't home at the time, but, I mean, he had a campus job, and sometimes he would stay after school to play basketball, so him not being home wasn't unusual. But, yeah, my wife came home a few hours after I came home, and when she went to return his yearbook to his room, it was on her computer desk, she went into his room, and she found this letter laying on his bed. And she ran to me with it immediately, and as I read it, just fear began to grip me. My son was failing college. He didn't know how to face me with this failure, face us with this failure. And he just said that, you know, every bird had to leave the nest sometime, just this tear-jerking letter, and that his car would be parked at the Greyhound bus station in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So my wife and I, excuse me, hurriedly just drove to the bus station, which was around a 20-minute drive. And when we got there, I ran to the door, pulled on the door, and the bus station had closed about 30 minutes earlier. So we circled the streets to try to find his vehicle, and two streets over we found his car. So we knew he'd gotten on a bus, and we knew because of his financial situation that wherever he got off of that bus, he would be broke and he would be homeless.
Okay. And I'm sure the emotional piece had to be overwhelmingly devastating to know that your child, just 18, and we know 18-year-olds today are not what 18-year-olds were when we were 18. they're
true.
A sensitive breed, you know, and it's a cruel world out there, and it's a lot crueler than
yeah.
It was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. So as a parent, I can only feel your pain. So take us on your journey. You got your blazer, right? Red blazer.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
you went down south from Michigan to Dayton, Ohio, because that was the first lead, correct?
Yes, that was the first lead we had. We finally got a hold of my son's girlfriend. We had left a message, and she finally called back a few hours later. And after explaining to her what had happened, the only thing that she could remember was that he had mentioned the city of Dayton, Ohio, in one of their conversations. She didn't even know why. But since that was the only clue I had, I immediately headed for Dayton, which was around a 3.5-hour drive away. About halfway along the way, halfway there, my wife and his girlfriend Ashley had been going through his room trying to figure out what he would have worn, what he took with him. And in doing so, they searched his trash can in his bedroom, and they found an address in the trash can. And the address was to a homeless shelter in Dayton, Ohio. They looked that up on the internet. And so I was so afraid up until that moment. I thought, oh, I have hope now. This must be where he's gone. And so I actually sped up a little quicker and tried to get there a little faster. And when I arrived in Dayton, I arrived just about midnight, maybe a little bit after, and I saw a police car on the side of the road. So I thought, he can help me. I pulled over. I explained to him what I was doing. And so he told me he could take me to the bus station. So that's where we did. We headed to the bus station. We arrived just before 12:30 after midnight. And when we did, the bus station had just closed at midnight. So there was no one around. I gave him the address to the homeless shelter, which was directly down the street from the bus station. And so we went to the homeless shelter, rang the buzzer, and a gentleman on the other side informed me that since my son was 18 years old, he couldn't tell me if he was in there or not. So he told me that at 7 in the morning, they made everyone leave, and if my son was inside, he would come out. So I waited outside the homeless shelter all night long until 7 o'clock in the morning. And then once everyone began to come out, I waited and stood there, began talking to them. But once everyone had finally come out, I realized that my son wasn't one of them.
And so the anxiety continues and the roller coaster of emotions evolves. And so you're up and you're down and you're up and you're down. And you went to get your buddy in Lexington, Kentucky. And he came with you to search in Atlanta, right?
Yeah, because, after 7 o'clock in the morning when I found out my son wasn't in that homeless shelter, I knew that the bus station was going to reopen at 9 a.m. And so I actually went to a day shelter with the homeless people, waited there until just before 9 a.m. And, you know, in case my son came to that day shelter, I would catch him there. But at 9 a.m. when the bus station opened, I went there in Dayton, and I found out for the first time that my son's bus ticket that he had purchased in Ann Arbor, Michigan, was purchased to Atlanta, Georgia, which was now over 8 hours drive away from where I had spent the night. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I initially decided to go home, but realizing after a few miles that my son was the other direction, I couldn't go home. I turned around, headed south. And shortly after heading south, the thought came to me that I did have one of my best friends in the world lived in Lexington, Kentucky, which was just a little ways down the road from where I was at. So I called my friend Larry, and my friend Larry was home. And so he told me to pick him up. He was going to go to Atlanta and help me search. So really that saved my life because I was so depressed by now. I'd been up all night long. I'd worked the day before. I hadn't eaten. I hadn't drank anything. I was literally falling apart. So my friend, Larry, coming with me to Atlanta really saved my life.
Oh, you know, and the strength that he offered you was what got you through that whole leg of the trip, because it was at that point you had encountered quite a lot of situations. I found the serendipity of how God works quite amazing in the next play out, because as you went to Atlanta and you found the homeless shelter you found the bus station in Atlanta, it was in like a really bad part of town. And you wrote in the book how you had never seen so many angry people in one place. And
right.
It had to be an overwhelming, here you are devastated and kind of really not grounded because of the emotions that you've been on this whirlwind with. And now you're being approached by street people who, could rob you, kill you. And that was, you're talking back in 2002. I imagine if you were to repeat the same situation today, they would may not be even as kind to you as they were then. Because in 10 years, the world has changed in another realm.
Yes.
But you were generous, and my story, I'm rambling, but you were generous, and you had a mound of money that you started to give to these street people, explaining your story and wanting to find your son. Now,
yeah. Well, go ahead.
Let's forward on that. I'll give you the phone here now. You can speak.
Okay. Well, the amazing difference was that in Dayton, I was dealing with the homeless people. And you're right, I had a huge wad of money. When I had gotten paid Friday, and before I left, I even went to the bank and got more money because I had no idea how long I'd be gone. But the people in Dayton, the homeless people there, I tried to give them money because they took me to the day shelter. They tried to give me coffee and give me sandwiches to eat, which I couldn't do either. But I tried to give them money, and they wouldn't take it. But as we arrived in Atlanta at the bus station, which we had found out that was the bus station he had arrived at, when Larry and I climbed out of the car, we were immediately surrounded by a group of around 15 homeless people, and they were the opposite of the ones in Dayton. They weren't there to help. They wanted to know who we were, what we were doing there, and they were eyeing us as to what I can look back on now as maybe we were easy prey, someone they could take advantage of. But what they didn't realize was that, you know, my whole life I had been, you know, I had been raised an angry young man. I had been someone who got in fights regularly before I was married and had a son. And now in this situation that I was in, the anger in me, the fear in me had just turned me into somewhat of a caged lion. So, yes, I did pull this large money, a wad of money out in front of these homeless people, and I showed it to them. And I actually started handing money out to each one of them, and I showed them that wad of money, and I told them that if they helped me find my son, I'd give them all of it. And so, yes, it was probably, looking back, it wasn't the smartest thing to do. But, again, I was like a caged lion, and anything that would have happened at that moment, they would have had a fight that they would have remembered.
Right. And honestly, I mean, you know, you're in that mode of desperation, survivalism. And
desperate.
Honestly,
yes.
you are on reactionary mode. I mean, you're going to do whatever, whenever you need
Absolutely.
To.
Absolutely.
You know, there's
Absolutely.
No love greater than a parent and a child. And there's something that just makes us animalistic if we feel our child threatened. And
yes.
it's that core basic emotion that we go into survivalism. But the beauty of all of this story, Dave, is your son came home safely. He ended up finding one of the street people in Atlanta who asked him if his father drove a red Blazer. And how ironic is God?
Yes. Well, I mean, the initial bus station moment in Atlanta wasn't the only place I handed out money. As I walked the streets of Atlanta, as I searched under bridges, homeless shelters, everywhere we went, I would pull that wad of money out and I handed out money to people, ones, fives, tens. All along my way, I handed out money to people, and I told them, and I would show them that wad of money I had, and I said, if you help me find my son, I'll give you all of this. And so eventually, yes, my son, I think the day three or day four that he was missing, he bumped into a homeless person on the streets of Atlanta, and that person said that to him, does your dad drive a red Blazer? And my son told me later that his eyes just must have got unbelievably huge because he was so shocked that that person would know that. And he said, yes, my father does drive a red Blazer. And he said, he's handing money out to people all over the streets of Atlanta looking for you.
Oh, such a beautiful story. And so your son got back on a bus, right? Or was it a plane?
Yes, once he realized that, you know, his dad was searching for him and that his dad loved him and he could come home, he began to beg money on the streets. A couple of people that he had met on the streets, they had a sign and they had been begging money, and they had decided they were heading to Florida, and so they gave him their sign and they told him to go to the Atlanta airport, which was a good place to beg money. And so he went there, and he did. He begged money from enough people that helped him to buy a bus ticket back home. One of the amazing moments for him, too, was when he was walking back to the bus station from the airport. He had gotten enough money to buy a ticket home, and he was walking through a neighborhood. It was in the middle of the night, and he said a car stopped next to him. And he said, it was a black man, and, you know, my son's white. And this man said to my son, he said, what are you doing walking through this neighborhood? And my son said, well, I'm trying to get back to the bus station. And he said, you can't walk through this neighborhood at this time of night alone. They'll kill you. And he said, you get in this car right now. I'm taking you to the bus station. So this man, who he would later call his guardian angel, picked him up and gave him a ride to the bus station. And so there he purchased his ticket and started his journey home.
Oh, what a wonderful story. Now, in this process, Dave, you found your faith in God. Let's talk a little bit about that.
It was amazing transformation, because I was never raised in church. My wife was, and she knew of God, but when we got married, you know, I didn't want to go to church, and so my wife got away from going to church. But on the fifth day that my son was missing, and we had no clue, we were completely baffled. I mean, the police had gone through our computer. We filed a missing police report. We faxed his picture to every police station from Michigan to Florida, contacted John Walsh, I mean, posted his picture all over his campus. We'd done everything possible, humanly possible, that we could think to do, and we had no clues for where my son was at. But on that fifth day, I was so desperate that I had made an appointment with a psychic, and I was getting ready to walk out the door to the appointment, and something come over me and just made me feel that I had to go back into the to the shelter list that we've been calling in Georgia, all over Georgia and Atlanta, and call one more name before I left for my appointment to this psychic. And so when I called the next number, it was the Atlanta Church of God. And a lady named Paige answered the phone. And Paige told me, she said, after I told her the complete story, I just went really deeper this time. And Paige was crying on her end of the phone, and I was crying on my end of the phone. And Paige told me, she said, sir, she said, I don't know you, but if you come back to Atlanta searching for your son, she said, you come straight to this church. She said, you can stay with us. We'll feed you. We'll give you a car. We'll put somebody in the car with you that knows the streets of Atlanta. And if your son's here, we'll find him. And so when I hung the phone up, tears just streaming down my face, this Christian woman who didn't know me, but who wanted to do everything possible to help me, had touched me so deeply, and I just felt like I had just hit the wall and I couldn't go any farther. And I looked in front of me on the table when I'd hung the phone up, right in front of me on the table, my wife had set a Bible, and I saw that Bible, and I picked it up, and I pointed it towards heaven, and I said these words. I said, God, I said, I want to be just like this lady Paige. I want to always be part of the solution, never part of the problem again. I said, if you'll save my son, I'll serve you for the rest of my life. I'll never leave you. I'll always be part of the solution, never part of the problem again. And I set that Bible down on the table. And as soon as I did, the phone rang, and my son had come home.
Oh, amen. What a beautiful story, Dave. Thank you so much for sharing it today on our show. This is... You know, it's amazing how we're led through trials and events and situations in our lives that really trigger our desperation and our surrendering. And it's in that surrendering that you found your faith. And I find that time and time again from people who have either strayed from God or really never really gave God too much credit. Found
yes.
God through their deepest and darkest moments. And
yes.
That's when our soul really speaks to us. And if we can just
yep.
maintain that faith and know that we're never alone.
I believe that.
You know, we are always going to find God's inspiration to help us stand up again. God bless you, David.
Yeah.
God bless your wonderful son and family and beautiful wife and family. And thank you so much for sharing your truly gifted story with us today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Lisa. I just love telling the story, and to God be all the glory.
Amen. Thank you so much. May you have a beautiful weekend, and God bless you, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you. Same to you. God bless.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wasn't that a lovely story, everyone? I just truly loved how he told the story in the book, and emotional. It's so emotional. We, you know, as a parent, we all know that is a true heartbreak to feel those moments of angst with our children. And so now we move into our last segment with our wonderful nutritionist, Terry Cochran. I love this woman. She's so full of wisdom and insight and genius. And she's going to talk to us today about something not many of us are aware of, but is very, very, very important and is lurking in our kitchens. And so we are going to talk to Terry Cochran now about plastics and estrogen. Terry, thank you so much for being on the show today. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, and I've just been so inspired by the last story. What a beautiful story, and what a way to find God.
I know. Isn't that wonderful?
You never know how he's going to bring us together, but that's just a wonderful story.
I know. It really is.
It really is. Today we're going to talk about our toxic load, and believe it or not, we have over 3,000 chemicals that are added to our food supply, and more than 10,000, yeah, it's crazy, more than 10,000 chemical solvents, emulsifiers, and preservatives that are used in food processing.
Oh.
And so we are literally a toxic soup, and when newborns come out of the womb, they are already carrying over 700 chemicals in their little bodies.
No.
Yes. Oh. It's very frightening, and we take in toxins through our skin, through our mucous membranes, through our lung, and then, you know, primarily through food. But in terms of plastics, BPA, which is found in many of our plastics, has a tremendous effect on neurological function, on brain function. They've done studies on how it affects prostate health in the fetus. And then there's something called phthalates, which make plastic softer, which are even found in the enteric-coated pills that we take that are supposed to be healthy for us.
Right.
And that is known to mimic estrogen, to really impact thyroid function, and to disrupt brain and neurological function. So we are living with it in our homes. We are breathing it in through the toxic air. Our water is not clean. There was a study, a New York Times study, that was done just a few years ago, stating that an estimated 1 in 10 Americans have been exposed to drinking water that contains dangerous chemicals or fails to meet a federal health benchmark.
Mm-hmm.
So our water is also intoxicated. So we've got our food, our water, what surrounds us, carpets that have off-gassing, paints that have off-gassing. Of course, our food supply. The average American consumes 5 pounds of pesticides every year, which then can convert to xenoestrogen, which then have very disruptive consequences to our endocrine system. And in my practice, I see so it's incredible. I see so many young women that are estrogen dominant, as well as young men that are growing breast buds, young men that have a lot of fat around their middle that are teens. And that's just something of this generation. Typically, teenagers are at their height of metabolic function, and so they can pretty much eat and burn calories. Well, we're not seeing that anymore because of the estrogen content in our food, and sadly, estrogen is deposited in our fatty tissue. So the more fatty or adipose tissue that we contain, the higher that estrogen load in our system, which is then going to further disrupt endocrine function.
Wow. So basically what we're dealing with our generation of teenagers today is not only are we, you know, not seeing them outside playing and being physical as maybe our generation was because of video games and inside computers and all those things, but they're also absorbing more toxins from the packaging and the chemicals and the additives that are going in the foods that they eat.
That's correct. That's correct.
So
and
basically
really
where – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
So basically when we're looking at where our bodies should be at our most functioning perfectly and our most optimal health in our teenage years, we're actually seeing our most dysfunctional bodies. I mean, there's a lot of overweight teenagers.
Exactly. And not only in the obesity, I'm seeing so many young women with polycystic ovarian syndrome. I'm seeing a lot of POTS, which is a kidney digestive condition. I'm seeing so much autoimmune disorder in terms of diabetes, in terms of autism. It's just, my practice has really become very much a practice of seeing young individuals. And this summer is heightened in the sense that they're all home from college and they're coming here and they're really disrupted. Girls are not gaining the freshman 15, they're gaining the freshman 50.
Really?
Yes. I'm seeing a lot of pituitary dysfunction. And that goes to copper in the liver, but it also goes to what's called enterohepatic recirculation, wherein it's a fancy word of saying what I call the estrogen spin cycle. Estrogen can only be broken down and converted from a fat-soluble to a water-soluble through the liver. If the liver is congested with all the toxic load, then we can't convert that estrogen and metabolize it. So they're getting really sick. So how do we deal with this? How do we deal with this toxic environment, with the estrogen in our food supply, with the plastics in our home? Well, the first thing we have to do is look around us and get rid of every plastic that you can in your kitchen. Do not microwave in plastic. Microwave in glass. Use glass containers only. Make sure you're using BPA-free water bottles. If you're taking water bottles, or I suggest you use the glass water bottles that have insulation on the outside so they don't break easily. Microwaving, if you do microwave only in glass, looking at your carpets, are they off-gassing, and then potentially moving to wood floors that have low VOC and water-based stains. You know, if you're going to rehab your home, don't try to do it in the winter where there's no source of ventilation. But the most important thing is our bodies, and we really need to get our livers and our kidneys and our skin clear. The skin is the third organ that will produce, it's a detoxifier, and so these kids, when they're teenagers and they have a lot of acne, it's because their livers are congested and there's no place for those hormones to be converted. And so how do we keep our livers clean? Well, we absolutely have to eat a lot of greens, in particular the cruciferous vegetables, those that contain L-glutamine, indole-3-carbinol. Why is that so important? Is because we have two phases of liver detoxification pathways, and the cruciferous vegetables activate both phases. They are good for both phases of liver detox. And I see a lot of clients that are very hormone toxic and or hormone imbalanced, and what they're given are more hormones. Yes, they may be too high in estrogen and too low in progesterone, but even giving progesterone to a body that is incapable of metabolizing hormones just creates more hormone toxicity. So you first have to look at the liver and the kidneys, clear them, then you could potentially add some naturally based plant-based hormones. So the liver is critical, and we need certain amino acids like choline, like methionine, like we need the B vitamins that are so important, methylfolate and vitamin B12 are so important for the sulfation and methylation pathways of the liver detoxifying pathways. Those two pathways are integral in converting and what I call disassembling our hormones, and then they are able to be broken down and excreted through the feces. So we really have to keep our livers and our kidneys clean. But our liver pumps 2 gallons of blood every minute through our system. And so we have to get those main organs of detoxification, they have to become clean. And I have something called the allergy stacking theorem, which says that our body always wants to go to homeostasis. But when we have one allergy over another, not even allergy, it could be just a toxin or a pesticide or a preservative, something that the body has to metabolize, if it's got so much in the system, it'll eventually start becoming symptomatic through overt allergies, hives, weight gain, depression, weight, adrenal dysfunction, acne, severe menopause symptoms, you name it. There's just a gamut of symptoms that occur when we are toxic. And so, you know, the great toxicologist said that the poison is in the dosing. And so we see all of these things that said, well, you can absorb this amount at these levels. You know, we have government approvals on all these microtoxins. But what I've never seen is a study that accumulates all these microtoxins and says, okay, you can take these all together and it's still safe.
Right. Right. So basically, is there something we could bring into our diet or supplements that would help cleanse or, you know, filter some of these toxins out of our body or help
Absolutely.
Filter the toxins out?
Yes. So one of the great things is it's just a really old remedy, apple cider vinegar. For most good raw apple cider vinegar is a tremendous liver tonic, and they've done studies that most centenarians in their lifetime have been they have been consistent consumers of daily intake of apple cider vinegar, and you can take up to 1 tablespoon in water daily. That's a great tonic. It tastes quite good, actually. But, you know, I would start slowly at maybe 1/2 teaspoon to 1/4 teaspoon in 8 ounces of water. Cilantro and chlorella are phenomenal as chelating agents for any heavy metals. So taking those together are also very important in therapeutic doses. Again, the cruciferous vegetables of broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, watercress, arugula, those activate those phase one, phase two liver detoxification pathways that help that. And then again, the supplements of choline, methionine, methylfolate, and B12 activate that sulfation and methylation pathway that's so important for disassembling the hormones and converting them from fat-soluble to water-soluble.
Oh, wonderful. Now, in eliminating the plastics from our kitchen, that means all the Ziploc baggies, that means our containers that we put leftover foods in, that means our plastic cups. Am I right?
That's correct, because they leach. And what I have found is, especially if you're putting in, you know, what do we put in plastic baggies when we send our kids to school in? Typically fruit that's been cut. Well, those fruits have enzymes. What do enzymes do? They break things down. What is it doing? It's breaking down the plastic right into our fruit. So,
oh, wow.
You know, it's just a double whammy. So there's some things called new skins or lunch skins that are completely washable. My daughter takes them to school every day instead of the plastic baggies. They're a little bit more expensive, but actually at the end of the year, you've saved yourself money and you've not increased the carbon footprint and you're not increasing your toxic load. And I know
right.
that Costco sells a lot of glass-based food containers that you should store your food in that. And if you do have plastic, please don't microwave in it or put in hot food into those plastic containers. If you only have plastic, make sure that food gets to room temperature before you start storing it in that plastic.
Okay.
But, you know, the best case scenario would be to just take that plastic to a recycling area and go to Costco or Walmart and get yourself some glass container-type storage for food, leftovers, and so forth in the kitchen. And, again, you know, don't try not to use plastic utensils when you're cooking. Try not to use plastic utensils. Everything leaches.
Such
good tips, Terry. Thank you so much. This is an eye-opener. I've been trying to eliminate plastics from my kitchen for months now, and it's not as easy as you think because there's so much packaging, you know. Things come in packages. You know, even meats come in plastic. When you go to the butcher, you have to ask for, no, not the plastic, please, the butcher paper. So,
exactly.
You know, there's these things that you have to catch mindfully every moment. Thank you so much, Terry Cochran. I appreciate you and your wisdom so very much. Please tell our audience how they can find you.
Well, they can find me through my website, which is healingpathsva.com, or if you just Google my name, Terry, T-E-R-I, Cochran, C-O-C-H-R-A-N-E. I have also a Twitter and a Facebook and a blog page, and I have written a book, Restorative Recipes, A Mindful Path to the Essential You, that really speaks to this, and you can purchase that via my website as well.
Oh, thank you so much, Terry. You are a godsend. I love your wisdom. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Unlimited Realities today. God bless you. Have a wonderful week. Okay.